Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for all of you today. My guest will be Wes Gillingham. And Wes is the co-founder of the Catskill Mountain Keeper. And I will tell you more about him when he is coming on. But first, I want to share with you some things going on in and around the New York metropolitan area, some things that are in the news, and, of course, share my weekly recipe with you. First off, I want to just share with you an event that is coming up here on Long Island that my local Slow Food chapter is hosting. Slow Food North Shore is the chapter that serves Queens and Nassau County and Western Suffolk County. And we are hosting a winter soiree at a wonderful Snail of Approval restaurant called Osteria Liana, and that's in Oyster Bay. And it's an unbelievable, unbelievable menu we have designed for you. It consists of everything served family style. And so we're starting off with seven antipastas. And we have roasted baby carrots with honey ricotta on the side. And so we've designed a lot of it so that it's gluten-free or vegan optionals. So, you know, where this is normally served with the honey ricotta cheese, you can get that on the side. There's polenta tots with a garlic aioli, a mushroom salad with truffle dressing. That's gluten-free, a burrata with pomegranate balsamic and grilled crostini, and you can have that also gluten-free. Roasted Brussels sprouts that are gluten-free and vegan, and winter greens and French radishes with a cucumber dressing, and also served with Parmesan cheese on the side if you are dairy-free. And then there's five different pastas that we are highlighting. Two of them are gluten-free. One is a potato gnocchi, so that's always, gluten-free. And it is not, although it is not dairy-free. And also a hazelnut mushroom pesto on a gluten-free spaghetti that is delicious. There is one item that is not vegetarian. That's a white wine clam tagliatelle. And that is our one ode to seafood. And then there's three different desserts, and everything is served family style, as I said, so it's a sharing opportunity, so you can, you know, if you don't eat one thing, you can have more of something else, and you just, you know, pass the plate around and share it with everybody. And we have wine and beer included, and it's only $60 for members and $70 for non-members of Slow Food. So I really hope you will consider joining us for this wonderful winter soiree. This has been somewhat of a mild winter here in Long Island, but we are still really excited to get through this winter and get ready for spring. So come on out and join us for that. A couple other things coming up. There is a new organization called Transitioning Port Washington, which is a local group that is working towards sustainable issues in Port Washington, and they are screening three different films. One is Paris to Pittsburgh, it's part of an Earth Day festival that they are putting together. That's going to be on February 28th. Another one is Just Eat It, which is a food waste story, on March 20th. And the last one that they'll be showing is called Disobedience, which is about civil disobedience, and should be another great film that they're showing actually on Earth Day, April 22nd, at the Port Washington Library. So check those out. We also will be hosting the Long Island CSA Fair, which is the Community Supported Agricultural Fair that we did last year, along with Slow Food North Shore and NOFA New York. NOFA stands for the Northeast Organic Farming Association. And my guest that will be coming on in just a little bit, he is on the board along with me. And NOFA is a wonderful organization, and we are bringing our Long Island farmers together to highlight their community-supported agricultural programs. And what that means is it's an opportunity for you to purchase fresh, organic, locally grown vegetables every week although you buy a share at the beginning of the season, so you actually are paying up front, giving the farmer the money when they need it to purchase their seeds and different amendments that they might need for the soil. And then every week you will get a fresh basket of that week's harvested vegetables. And it's really wonderful, but it's also a wonderful opportunity to meet the different farmers, find out how they run their program, where they drop off, or whether you need to go to the farm to pick it up. Some CSA programs offer extra options like eggs, cheese, organic meat, flowers, or fruit, while some just focus on the vegetables. And then there's a CSA that will be there that just focuses on medicinal herbs. So there's really quite an array of options, and the prices also have quite a range. So you really want to see what is the best community-supported agricultural program for you, whether you need a full share or a half share every week or every other week. These are all options that you really can find out about at the Long Island CSA Fair, so come on out to that. Food and Water Watch, which is a wonderful organization that NOFA New York and Slow Food often partner with, they are having their 15th anniversary benefit in New York City on March 24th. And everyone is invited. Go to the Food and Water Watch website to find out more information about it, or I have links for all of these things on my website at iegreen.com. Just go to events and they'll all be listed there. And now I would like to share with you my weekly recipe. Actually, first, let me just talk to you a little bit about some of the things that I wrote about this week in my newsletter. First off, I want to make sure that everybody listening is registered to vote in the primary. And believe it or not, the deadline for registration is tomorrow, Friday, Valentine's Day, February 14th. So if you have not registered yet, you can do it online or you can download the form. And again, I have a link on my website. You can download the form, print it up, and send it overnight because it really needs to be in the Board of Elections office tomorrow morning, not postmarked. It actually has to arrive there by tomorrow, Friday, February 14th. So please, it's really so important that we all vote. And you're not locked into the party that you register for initially. You can always change it. So if you want to be Democrat this time, but another time you want to be independent or Republican, you can do that. But right now, we need everybody to register and place your votes. It's just so important. And then another thing I wrote about this week was about the school lunch program. As you know, the current administration is rolling back some of the healthy standards that the Obama administration had put into the healthy school lunch program. And he's rolling it back because, I don't know why, because he doesn't like children, because he doesn't care about kids being healthy. I don't know. But what I do know is that we need to really hold the schools accountable and try to keep them on track with the healthy school food that they were starting to provide. And we also need to encourage more students to participate. The more students that participate, the more money that the school districts have to actually improve the school lunch program. So it's a bit of a catch-22 because while the food's not good, you know, you can't blame parents for wanting to pack lunch. But unfortunately, for so many young people, they live in families that can't afford to pack them lunch. And so the school lunch program is the food that they need to depend on. So it's really, really important that the food that we're giving to these kids is healthy. So please support your school lunch programs and help them feed the kids that really need the food. So this week, I wanted to make a dish that we could sit around the living room and eat while watching the Academy Awards, which is something I don't do often. We're usually sitting at our dining room table, but I wanted something that we could really just eat lightly around the coffee table in front of the TV while we watched the Academy Awards. So I made this chipotle tempeh with black beans and vegetable burrito. And it was just so great, and it comes together really fast. Of course, this was a weekend meal, but it could easily be a midweek meal because so much of the ingredients were really just stuff that I had in my pantry. So it was, pretty easy. I always keep tempeh in my refrigerator because it keeps well. So I had one block of tempeh. It's just an 8-ounce block. One organic onion chopped. One organic orange pepper chopped. Red pepper, green pepper, any one would work fine. One 8-ounce pack of baby Bella mushrooms. One small head of broccoli cut into small florets. A tablespoon of minced garlic. A tablespoon of tamari, which is a fermented soy sauce that is wheat-free, so it's a gluten-free option. A half a teaspoon salt, a half a teaspoon chili powder, and half a teaspoon of chipotle chili powder, which is a little bit spicier and has more of a deep, rooty taste to it than regular chili powder. One can of organic diced fire-roasted tomatoes. I have both regular fire-roasted tomatoes, and I also have in my pantry fire-roasted tomatoes with chili peppers. So depending on who you're making this for and how spicy you want it, you can either use just fire-roasted tomatoes or you can use fire-roasted tomatoes with chili peppers in it. One can of organic black beans, drained, and I usually purchase Eden brand beans because they are the only ones on the market that I know of that actually cook the beans with kombu, which is a seaweed that actually makes the beans less gassy. So I stick with those beans. A half a cup of frozen organic corn, cilantro for garnish, and some chopped red onions also for garnish. And I also had a jar of salsa in my pantry that I served with the burritos. And people could put that on as they saw fit. And I began by cutting the tempeh block into quarters. Ultimately, I was going for really small little cubes. So I cut the block into 4 quarters. And then I cut each of those quarters horizontally to make them thinner so that I now had 8 pieces. And then each of those quarters, I doubled them back up so they were quarters. I cut each one into thirds and then into little cubes. So these are really little cubes, like quarter-inch cubes of tempeh. And I sautéed the tempeh in some olive oil for about 5 minutes until they got golden brown on all sides. So you have to kind of turn the little pieces. Just keep shaking the pan around, and it works fine. But you want to get the tempeh golden brown so it's really a bit crispy. Then you're going to add the onions and the garlic and cook that for another 5 minutes or so. Then add the mushrooms and the peppers. And the mushrooms, if I didn't say so before, I sliced the mushrooms and I chopped the peppers. So I added the mushrooms and the peppers, cooked that down a little bit, added the chili powder, the chipotle powder, and the tamari, and a little salt and pepper. Then I added the broccoli florets and a can of fire-roasted tomatoes. And let that cook down a little bit till the broccoli starts getting soft. Then I added the black beans and the frozen corn, and I let that all come together for another 5 or 10 minutes, allowing the flavors to meld together and get hot. And that was it. And I served it inside of I had a whole wheat flour tortilla. If you are gluten-free, you can use a rice tortilla, or you can use corn tortillas. You can even use hard taco shells if you want to put this filling inside of taco shells instead of burrito. Any options work really fine. Or you can just serve it in a bowl with rice with some tortilla chips on the side. That's also great. And I served it with organic brown rice and some lime wedges and garnished it all with cilantro. One of my guests didn't like cilantro, so I kept that on the side and just garnished the dishes with that. But if you are a cilantro-loving family, you can add cilantro to the dish as well as using it for garnish. And then, as I mentioned before, I also served it with some fresh salsa and some chopped red onion. And that was it. It was really delicious. It came together very easily, and everyone loved it. So when you make these recipes, I'd love you to hashtag I Eat Green Recipes and post them online and share them with people. The more people making this great food, the healthier everybody will be. So please feel free to share that around. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest this week is Wes Gillingham. And Wes is the co-founder and associate director of the Catskill Mountain Keeper. And Catskill Mountain Keeper is dedicated to pushing New York into a just transition away from fossil fuels and protecting the ecological integrity of the whole region. Wes has lived off the grid, off the electric grid, for over 35 years, and he serves on the advisory board of the Center for Earth Ethics and the New York State Forest Preserve Advisory Committee. And he just recently returned to the board of the Northeast Organic Farming Association, so that we are now co-board members. He was on it many years ago and just returned back to it, so that's really exciting. And Wes and his wife, Amy, ran 150-family community-supported agriculture. So as I was talking about the CSA fair, Wes actually ran his own CSA program from his farm, but they had a horrible flood which ruined their business, and so that's when he branched out and co-founded the Catskill Mountain Keeper. And they mostly are working to lead the fight against fracking and fossil fuel extraction. So I'm going to let him tell us more about what he does. Wes, are you with me?
I am. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for joining me. So maybe you could tell us first, just start us off with, what was the inspiration behind you starting the Catskill Mountain Keeper?
So one of the things that happens with the Catskills, I mean, it's one of 13 places in the eastern half of the United States that actually has over 50,000 acres of wilderness, you know, contiguous, roadless area. It's been left alone by the state for many years, so it's an ecological gem. But what typically has happened over time is you have national green groups coming in on an issue when something is happening in the Catskills, and they focus on that, and then they disappear, or they come in and work on the New York City watershed, or and then, you know, or protect areas that are threatened. But then they aren't here. It's not organizations that have people that live here and work here leading policy. So that was the initial impetus for, you know, starting Catskill Mountain Keeper. It's also, the Catskills are surrounded by a bunch of small rural communities that have to deal with New York State DEC and the Forest Preserve issues, have to deal with New York City, Department of Environmental Protection, and the New York City's water system. And then, you know, it's five different counties. People on this side of the Catskills don't necessarily know what's going on in the community on the other side. So the idea was to bring the communities together so that we can all work on, you know, the future of the Catskills. Not long after we started working on Catskill Mountain Keeper, they were threatened by five casino proposal under the Pataki administration, and we made our way through that one, and all of a sudden we were faced with landmen coming into the Catskills wanting to lease land for natural gas, which woke a lot of people up, not just in the Catskills but all across the state. And we were part of getting the word out about fracking and eventually getting a ban, which it's an administrative ban that we have, but it's actually up, and there's potential for that ban to be permanent and codified into law this year in this legislative session. So, Catskill Mountain Keeper has, like I said, though, it's looking at the region. So we do a lot of different things. We have some school garden programs. We run a farmer's market. And we do something at the farmer's market. Sometimes farmers don't want to deal with a lot of protocol and such, so WIC checks, women and infant children checks, or the farmer's market nutrition program. What we did was we started a market where farmers could just take those checks, and then we would reimburse them instantly at the market. So they would come to us, give us these tokens that were used, and then we would just pay them right there. So they didn't have to deal with that. So that attracted farmers to come to that market, and you had to take those checks if you were at the market. And what's happened in Sullivan County, where we're situated, because of that market, they actually give out twice as many of those checks, which means twice as many people who really need that food are getting healthy, nutritious food that wouldn't necessarily be able to afford it or have access to it.
Now, clarify this for me, because I thought WIC, which is Women, Infant, and Children, I thought that program provided like milk and cheese, but they wouldn't pay the top money for organic. Am I mistaken? Will they cover organic milk?
You know, I don't know whether they actually pay the milk. I'm just mentioning, you know, we reimburse, and that's all of that is in flux because of the Trump administration and a whole bunch of proposals coming down the road.
Right.
And even in the budget that he recently proposed, he's talking about cutting a bunch of that stuff. So I don't even know how that's going to pan out in this market season. So I'm not sure I can really answer your question on that. But I used to take WIC checks when we were farming, and I may have misnamed that in terms of what we were reimbursed. It might have been the Farmers Market Nutrition Program that we were doing.
Oh, the SNAP coupon.
Yeah. Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. And so tell us a little bit more about your background and what inspired you to actually start this environmental organization.
Well, so I was in process of starting Mountain Keeper, and it was going to be a part-time thing. But what happened was our farm property is up on a ridge on marginal land, and when we started the CSA, we leased a piece of ground down on the river bottom. It was good barber loam, good sandy loam soil. It was very productive. We were able to feed 150 families for more than 10 years. But we had 200-year floods and a 500-year flood in a five-year period. The last time it had flooded had been 1943. And then that was 2006 when we had the 500-year flood. And it's actually flooded three times since then. So, you know, it was pretty obvious what was happening in terms of climate change and the impacts. So the work of Mountain Keeper getting out there, stopping fracking, working on climate policy, I have personal experience with the need for that.
Right.
And, you know, my background is kind of varied. I was on a 10-year schedule for many years. I taught college for 10 years. I was a park ranger for 10 years. I ran the farm for 10 years. the thing that I had done when I was teaching, I wasn't teaching at your standard college. I worked for a program called the National Audubon Society Expedition Institute. It was run by the Institute for Expedition Education out of Maine. And I used to teach the Montana, Wyoming, and South Dakota semester in the fall. I'd get 20 college students, and we'd travel around that region, meeting with what we called resource people, experts in the field, whether it was, you know, a farmer on the ground or a policymaker. And we went through that whole region holistically looking at the ecology of the area, the cultural history, and the you know, the ecological and natural history issues that were, you know, melding into politics. That's part of the success of the fracking fight in New York. Is I had spent a lot of time in Wyoming where gas drilling had been taking place. So when I found out that they were proposing to go after the Marcellus Shale in New York, alarm bells went off for me.
Mm-hmm.
I taught that in the fall, and then every spring I either worked in the desert southwest or the southern Appalachians and the Everglades. And when we'd go into these regions, we'd meet with the people in the communities, whether it was on a Native American reservation or the local fishing community or the farming community. And that was part of how I even started the farm, was my wife and I had a really good understanding of how food was produced in this country on the commercial scale and the need for alternatives. So that's why we started a small CSA. I had grown up working on a farm from the time I was 12 years old until I graduated high school. So,
where did you grow up?
In Western Connecticut. Although I live on a piece of property, my parents bought a piece of property that was halfway between that and where my mom grew up in up in Herkimer County, New York, on a dairy farm. And so the property I live on now has been in our family since the 50s, and I moved here in 1984.
So, are you in Western Connecticut, or are you in?
No, this is in the Catskills, right here in Livingston Manor.
And when did you form the Catskill Mountain Keeper? What year was that?
Announced, we worked on it, I think, for 2 years, and then we came out publicly in 2006, the same year I got flooded.
Okay, so it's been around for a while now, because it's new to me. I had not heard of it. And, you know, as I perused your website, I was fascinated with all the things that you were working on, involved with. Like I said, I've worked with, you know, Slow Food and Food and Water Watch a lot, and that's how I first learned about fracking and you know what was going on upstate and the need for keeping fracking out. However, we still have a problem with fracking because we still participate in importing the fracked waste and gas from Pennsylvania. Is Catskill Mountain Keeper involved in trying to minimize that aspect of it?
Yeah, and we were part of a group of organizations that stopped the Constitution Pipeline and the Ned Pipeline that were coming up from Pennsylvania and crossing through the western side of the Catskills. We thought that was almost dead. We had survived multiple attempts, even the Constitution Pipeline Company trying to take it to the Supreme Court. But then there was some recent judgments on another case under the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission out west that now we're having to go back to court to defend New York State's right to deny a pipeline on under the Clean Water Act. The Clean Water Act is a national statute, but New York State denied its 401 water quality certificate, which basically is when the state says that, yes, they're fulfilling this national policy, but the state said they did not do it, which they didn't. So we're still fighting on that front. We also work in the Delaware River Basin. We're trying to get a full ban, when I say a full ban on fracking in the Delaware River Basin, not just a ban on the drilling, but also the waste and or having a waste facility and or even taking water out of the Delaware for fracking someplace else. And that's all in process.
Yeah, these pipeline companies are relentless. I mean, they keep coming back. You know, you win the lawsuit, and then they come back again. They're just like, you know, the Energizer Bunny. They just don't give up. And it's so hard. It's really tough, you know, because all of the grassroots organizations, you know, we're nonprofits and we're small, you know, volunteers, and it's just so hard. I mean, the Williams Pipeline down here in the city, you know, that's going to go from Pennsylvania through New Jersey into Staten Island across New York Harbor to Long Island. I mean, it's just, it's asinine. You know, these pipelines, they all leak. And it's just so risky and it's so ridiculous. And so it just doesn't make sense to be banning fracking but allow the fracked waste and gas to come on in. So,
yeah, part of the story is that the industry has got a huge push to build these pipelines right now because I think they're seeing the writing on the wall that communities around the country are wanting to switch and make a just transition away from fossil fuels. But if they can get these things built and put in place, it's kind of like, you know, we'll be addicted to that process for a while. And then the other thing is if they can get it through New York into the Canadian and New England system, that gives them access to then be able to export natural gas and into Europe.
Right. Well, that's the other thing that makes me crazy is that here the New Yorkers will be taking all the risk of the possibility of a leaking pipeline, and it's not even, most of it's not even for our use. It's for export. So it's just, you know, even more of a reason not to not to support it.
Absolutely.
But anyway,
that was that was one of the reasons we started working with New York Renews, which is a coalition of almost 200 organizations, to come up with the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. Our version was the Climate and Community Protection Act, but at the end of the legislative session last year, it got tweaked in a couple of ways and changed its name, and we lost some things in there and some other things got stuck in, but we do have in New York State the strongest climate legislation out there, and it will mandate, there's a whole process to implement this, and everybody's going to have to be all hands on deck to make sure it's done properly, but we have the opportunity in New York to really lead and get the just transition underway and to move away from fossil fuels. And in that legislation, there is language in there that basically all new big proposals have to go through a climate test. So the DEC will have the responsibility of analyzing a comprehensive greenhouse gas equivalent analysis, as this gets implemented, it will be a lot easier to stop any of these projects.
Mm-hmm. And how does that overlap with farms and food? Like, how do you see the fracking situation affecting local farms?
The issue with farming, for farmers who are on the margins, I mean, it's pretty attractive to get a lease. But what's happened in a lot of places in Pennsylvania is what seemed attractive and was an influx of money early on has shifted away. And then what you're left with is the issue of contaminated groundwater or spills on the surface. I mean, there's a host of things that it sounds like you're pretty well aware of. Fracking and farms don't mix. That's pretty straightforward.
Were farmers allowed to make leases with the fracking companies, or because it was banned, they weren't allowed to, or were some of them already in place and they were grandfathered in?
There were a ton of leases that were taken out in New York, but if the ban actually, some folks were able to get that initial lump sum payment, they're not getting any royalties because they're not allowed to drill. So some people made some side cash there. But the leases were taken out anticipating a huge influx of infrastructure and gas in the gas drilling in the state. There were a lot of leases already taken out.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I know NOFA is working on, we were talking about this when we were up there at the NOFA conference, is the Soil Health Bill. Can you talk a little bit about the Soil Health Bill and what, I know Catskill Mountain Keeper is working on that too. What are you looking to get passed with the Soil Health Bill?
So we're in an interesting time in terms of, I just mentioned that climate legislation, and one of the things that's in there is the development of an agriculture and forestry advisory group that then will work on the plan to implement the CLCPA. And one of the opportunities we have, because agriculture has a huge opportunity to help with carbon sequestration, so having farms, by improving their soil, which improves their bottom line because they have more productive soil, they can produce more and sell more and be more economically viable, but then at the same time, you're taking carbon out of the atmosphere and putting it into the soil. And it actually, when you are improving your soil, you're also preventing, not preventing, but you no longer need to rely on commercial fertilizers, which, you know, ammonium nitrate, when you apply that, you know, soil nitrogen fertilizers to the soil, it actually releases nitrous oxide into the atmosphere, which is, you know, way worse than carbon. I mean, we're talking, depending on how it's counted, anywhere from 100 or 150 times as potent as carbon in terms of impacting the climate. So the less we use that fertilizer, the better for climate and climate change, the better for farmers to have better soil, and then we're actually taking carbon out of the atmosphere. So it's a really huge opportunity that we need to jump on. And I see some of the climate policy and transition that, you know, we're going to be going through over the next few years is really being a good thing for agriculture across the state.
Mm-hmm. And in this new climate bill, is there more regulation on not being able to use the synthetic fertilizers, or is that still being allowed?
So the way the bill is written, it addresses not just carbon in the atmosphere, but greenhouse gas equivalents. So that was done especially to include co-pollutants from any kind of polluting facility. Because historically, you know, what happens is, you know, the compressor station or the generating facility, the polluting entity is usually put in a community that has, it's a disadvantaged community, it's either low income, people of color, poor rural communities, that people don't have the political inertia to prevent that from happening in their community.
Right. A disenfranchised community.
Yeah, disenfranchised.
Where they can take advantage.
Uh-huh. People on the front lines, and they end up dealing with the impacts of those things. So the way the bill was written to really include that and recognize that. So the nitrous oxide releases from commercial fertilizer down the road when they come up with the plan will be impacted by that. Right now, what that actually looks like, it isn't completely spelled out. That was in order to get this bill passed. You couldn't write everything into it in terms of, you know, down to the minute detail, because you needed to bring in stakeholders to develop that. And that's what the, you know, the Climate Action Council that's been put together between the governor, the legislature, and with some other representatives from around the state, to work on what that plan looks like and how to implement it. And then there's these working groups and advisory panels that will help with that from the communities that are affected. There's an environmental justice group. There's a, as I mentioned, the ag and forestry group. And all of this, in that the one thing that changed in the bill was it, in terms of zero emissions, it turned to net zero at the end of session, which means about 15% of the facility, let me back up a little bit, facilities like a aluminum smelter or a cement plant, that there isn't really a technology to just turn it over to electric right now, are still going to need to operate. And you could have had a system set up where, it's offsets, kind of like the old cap and trade, where people are still dealing with the pollution, and they get away with it because they buy a piece of property in the Adirondacks or something. But we put a bunch of guardrails in the bill to prevent that straight-up trade. There will those communities are still going to be dealing with that pollution for a little while, but it actually will, over time, work away from that. It's a really comprehensive piece of legislation.
Yeah, I worked with New York.
But we're kind of getting off on a tangent away from the soil health bill. The thing about the soil health bill is the opportunity, because of that climate policy, there's a need to do it because it spells out that will happen under the climate policy, and it gives the opportunity farmers to come out and get a bill in place that is about taking care of the soil. It's not, although it has those climate advantages and the need to do it because of the climate bill, but it actually gives farmers opportunity to put in place things that they know work, whether it's cover cropping, buffers. There's a whole host of things that the agricultural community has been using for a really long time to protect the soil and improve farms. And so if we create legislation today that will do that, and then it has the added benefit to the whole state in terms of climate policy. But it's actually written from the farmer's perspective and the farmer's knowledge of the soil and mm-hmm. how to interact with their crops.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's exciting. Now we just need to get the right people in there to implement it so that it actually happens, right?
Right.
That's a whole other part to it. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And if you're just joining us, my guest is Wes Gillingham. He is the co-founder of the Catskill Mountain Keeper, and we're just talking about the work that they are doing up in the Catskill region and what they're doing to protect the land and help the farmers out. And so, Wes, can you share with us what other issues are you really working on at the Catskill Mountain Keepers, besides these big ones like fracking and energy?
Well, I think, with the fracking, the way we were able to defeat that was working in coalition, not just going out there saying Catskill Mountain Keeper wants you to do this, but actually working with a cross-section of organizations. And that's the same thing. That's how we got the climate bill passed and turned into law, because there was like I said, almost 200 organizations, a lot of environmental justice groups, labor organizations, and the standard, environmental groups working together mm-hmm. to make something happen. And there's another like mini coalition coming together right now around the issue of bees and pollinators and the use of certain insecticides. I've been spending a lot of time talking to folks in Albany, trying to get to push the birds and the Bees Protection Act, which is a 5-year moratorium.
And the neonicotinoids, right?
On neonicotinoids. I mean, what we're finding, these things have only been around since the 90s, and the alarm bell is going off because the bee populations are dropping, and it's being associated to this. But they're kind of the canary in the mine. If the bee populations are dropping, the honeybee population, so are probably the wild bees, plus countless insects of various forms, which, that's the base of the food community in any ecosystem. It's pretty alarming. In Japan, when they introduced them into using them in rice fields, the eel population and smelt populations in the watershed where these eel farms were, where these rice fields were, dropped drastically. And this stuff is scary because, and it kind of blows me away when they use systemic pesticides, because if you look at pesticide problems and things that have been banned over time, systemic pesticides rise to the top of that list. Like Long Island's water still has Temic in it from the old potato fields. Temic was, you sprayed it on the potato field and then the whole plant became toxic to the bugs because it was systemic. It would turn the whole plant into a waste dump, a toxic waste dump, basically. And right now what we're doing with Neonix is one of the common uses is a seed treatment. So they put it on the seed. You take a corn seed or a soybean seed, and you coat it with Neonix, and then you plant that. 5% of the volume of insecticide that you put on that seed actually makes it into the plant. It's very effective, though. It makes it into, it's a neurotoxin. It makes the bugs that are going to start feeding on that causes paralysis, and they die. But the other 95% that you put on that seed goes out into the soil. That scares the bejesus out of me when I think about when we were doing our CSA, and you know, we weren't doing a 100-acre field of sweet corn. We were doing two or four beds of planting. I would plant another two beds of corn because we were trying to do it on a timing that we could put a certain amount of corn in each weekly delivery for the CSA. And if I didn't cover those corn beds with Reme, a row cover, the birds would come in and pick half of it out. So we'd get like half the germination. That's not as noticeable when you're doing a 100-acre field of corn because there's plenty to eat out there. But we're talking about on one individual seed, a typical neonicotinoid coating has enough active ingredient in it to kill 250,000 bees. And then, it can kill a songbird just eating that one seed. And Neonix have become the most commonly used pesticide in the U.S. right now. This is serious stuff. It has really serious implications for the entire ecosystem, not just farms. They're incredibly persistent. They're showing up in people. Like the CDC did some testing on folks, federal workers, and 53% of the people had Neonix in their urine samples. Mm-hmm. The 30% of Long Island's water testing that they did showed up with Neonix, so the moratorium will give us 5 years to actually look at what's happening and make a decision about, okay, we should not be using these in our state or anywhere anymore. It's been banned in the European Union, so we should follow suit in our state.
Yeah, absolutely. God, there's so many issues. Let's talk about the dairy crisis that we have been hearing about, but I think a lot of people don't really understand what is at the crux of the dairy crisis. Can you shed a little light on that?
Yeah, so, that has really come to our attention up here in the Catskills because a lot of the, the Catskills has always been much smaller family-owned farm. The river valleys aren't as big as when you get up into the central part of the state. So the farms that are here have really figured out how to work their land and make a living at it. But what's that means is they're not the 2,000 cow dairy or the big herds. They're smaller amounts, which means it takes more farms to fill up a milk truck. And what's happened over time is Dairy Farmers of America, which is a farmer, quote-unquote, farmer-owned co-op. I say quote-unquote because it's gotten to be such a big entity. They have executives who are flying around the country in the company jet, but it's still technically a co-op, but the way that this has all happened has pushed out a lot of the smaller farms. And here in Sullivan County, they're the only person you can sell your milk to. So they basically have a monopoly on purchasing milk, which means that they that equals a huge impact on their ability to set prices. In fact, there was a lawsuit against them that they paid out, they settled out of court. Not all farmers took that money. There are still farmers who are fighting it and continuing the lawsuit. But Dairy Farmers America is in process right now of buying Dean Foods. And if that goes through, 80% of all dairy products in the United States would be owned by Dairy Farmers of America. And they get away from a straight-up monopoly lawsuit by any government entity because of a bill that was put in place in the 30s that protects co-ops from a monopoly lawsuit.
Are there certain rules that designate what a co-op is so that a corporation can't really be a co-op?
Yeah, there's a whole outline. And I mean, basically, they take dues from farmers. When you start selling your milk to Dairy Farmers of America, you have to pay into the co-op. And then there is a system where they're going and voting on a local level. But then how it functions on the national level is very different than what you would think, farmers' choices would be. It's really, in the Northeast, it's really driven the price of milk into the ground. And then you have, situations where farms in the Midwest who are selling their milk for even cheaper are shipping it into New York State and dropping. And then you have processors dropping farms because they can get it cheaper from Ohio than the local farms here. There's a whole bunch of sort of tactics that some farms are doing. They're trying to build their own creameries, which ends up into a whole issue around that with New York State Ag and Markets in terms of getting approval for that, the size of creameries. There's so many issues here. We really need to readjust how... number one, how that co-ops function, and then number two, how milk pricing functions. We really need parity pricing in this country to protect farmers.
Mm-hmm.
One of the issues, as this was breaking, is some of the organizations out there is like, well, we need to open up the market in Canada, and Canada has unfair trade, and that morphed into a whole. Thing with the Trump administration in Canada. But if you just look over the border of New York into Canada, you see a system where small farms are protected from these huge fluctuations in price, which drives a lot of them out of business and just encourages bigger and bigger farms, which we see all the issues there.
God, there are so many issues, but I'm so glad to know of your organization that you're up there doing work and protecting the beauty of, the Catskill region, which is really a local treasure. Can you just share, we're almost out of time, can you share with everyone listening how they can find your organization and get involved?
So it's CatskillMountainKeeper.org is our website.
Okay.
And we're right in Livingston Manor. If you're driving through Livingston Manor, stop in our office and say hello.
Okay. Sounds great. Well, Wes, thank you so much for making the time to join me today on my show. And really keep up the work, and I look forward to getting to know you more and working with you with the Northeast Organic Farming Association.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Everyone out there, thank you for joining us, and I'll see you again next week. Bye for now.